This is a Building Bridges, your community and labor report, AFL-CIO convention special, produced by Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Later in the program, we'll bring you a report on the Iraq War resolution passed at the AFL-CIO convention. But first, in the midst of the anger and angst among the delegates at the convention over the pullout by the Change to Win coalition, the Reverend Jesse Jackson delivered a blockbuster speech at the convention which brought the House down. He warned that debate within labor must not prevent cooperation within the labor movement to fight the right-wing assault on the working class. His most resounding response from the convention delegates came when he repeatedly demanded that the troops must come home. Going forward, Jackson blasted the Democratic Party for its weak response against the right-wing agenda and demanded a new strategy to pressure both parties to respond to our issues. Labor must align with its partners in the civil, women's, environmental, and immigrants' rights communities in massive street actions to turn up the heat. Only then will the parties respond to our labor and community agendas for social change. And now, Jesse Jackson.
Blacks and Latinos must coalesce and not co-annihilate. We must learn to share power as we are doing now in Los Angeles, as we've done in Houston and Denver and Chicago. We must not fight each other over the crumbs. Under pressure, we cannot allow Mexican-American immigrants to be used as pawns and blacks to be scapegoats. We must turn to each other and not on each other. These groups now constitute the most available source of urban labor in the top 100 markets. Labor at every level, from service unions and to the building trades, must open up to these workers. These groups are allies. They must not be alienated for a lack of inclusion. Under pressure on labor, you must debate and you must change, but you must be able to differ and still come together. The intra-squad struggle must not leave so much blood on the field that you cannot compete in the interleague game. This fight is not us versus us, it's us versus them, and them is coming at us real hard. We must learn to fight internally but coalesce externally against those who would destroy both sides of internal struggles. Now, those who say labor must invest more in organizing workers and go south, for there are so many unorganized working poor, and they are right. Now, those who say we must wage political battles to strengthen both workers' rights, and they are right too. If the last two elections had not been determined by voter fraud and manipulation, we would have a tailwind behind our back. There would have been a sense of celebration as opposed to anger and anguish of the rightness of our cause. But because of the outcome of these two elections, we're now into radical introspection that could lead to disintegration of our strength. Now we must play on the pressure and against the clock. Now we must do a difficult thing and agree to disagree and still negotiate operational unity within our own family. Everyone who cares about progressive reform in America, civil rights, women's rights, the environment, workers' rights, decent wages, good education, affordable health care, secure retirements, a strong America has a stake in labor growing stronger, not weaker, bolder, and not broken. Change requires debate. Debate causes friction. Friction causes sparks. Those sparks can light the way if they do not burn the house down. Pressure won't stop until we release new energy to challenge it. Unity is not enough. If there is unified blindness, a one-eyed man is king in a blind city. If there is power not appropriately applied, we will not get the desired results. We need a vision that makes room for all of us. It must be accompanied by a will to fight and go public with our pain. Let us fight about the best way to organize and unite around a common external agenda. Empower workers and hold corporations accountable and start making sense in our trade policy. That's our struggle. Reinvest in America and put America back to work. Invest in people, not tax cuts for the few. Strengthen Social Security and stop the effort to dismantle it. Bush has offered a plan that has only two certain results: more poverty among seniors and more debt for the nation. We must unite to stop this threat to America's most successful social program, Social Security. What is our vision that unites us? Affordable health care for all, an education of equal high quality for all, good job with good wages, and lift the poor by raising the minimum wage. Good jobs through energy independence, as called for by the Apollo Alliance that labor leads, not a big oil energy plan that leaves us more dependent on the shifting sands of the Persian Gulf. Honor the soldiers and bring them home. And bring them home with a job when they get home, and health insurance when they get home, and a decent house when they get home. We should not occupy Iraq nor remain in the middle of a civil and religious war. We need a new hemispheric vision. Hear this. Immigration is up from 500,000 a year to about 2 million. Mexico is not back door. Mexico is next door. Regain the basic human right to organize. Maids in New York and Chicago make $18 to $20 an hour and receive health care and retirement benefits. Those same maids in Atlanta without a union make $8 an hour with no benefits. Current labor law puts workers at risk. Progressives of all stripes should join unified labor in demanding passage of the Employee Choice Act now. Our future is to confront the unorganized market, to challenge workers in the South, to choose real economic needs over culture, insecurity, and racial division. Just as slave labor and organized labor could not coexist, organized labor and right-to-work laws cannot long endure. We must fight right-to-work laws and give workers their basic American right to collective bargaining. Don't turn on each other. When they close your plant and cut the lights out and take your job to a cheap labor market abroad, whatever your racial or religious disposition may be, we all look amazingly similar in the dark. Let's turn the lights back on and put America back to work. Our allies in the Senate must not cozy up to wolf politics in sheep clothing. These right-wing ideologues want to return the Constitution to the days when labor unions were illegal as a restraint of trade, when corporations were free to trash the environment and exploit their workers, when apartheid was the law of the land. We must fight with full force and principle the right-wing's assault on our judiciary, its blatant power grab to stack the courts with radical conservative, anti-civil rights, anti-labor, anti-women, anti-environment, anti-justice judges. On these principles, we cannot compromise. When all the unions and protesting civil rights organizations and churches are under IRS audits and public broadcasting is under venomous attack, we have no choice but to fight back. We must show immediately that we will continue to build through the pressure and the heat. Even as we fight internally, we will coalesce against our enemies externally. So on August 6, 2005, the 40th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act, we'll march again. March to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act. March for workers' right to organize. March for comprehensive immigration reform. March for an end to the war in Iraq. March for high quality health care and education for all, we shall go back to the streets and take our case to the people. The right to vote and the right to organize, shared economic security and health security, go hand in hand. Thus we march in the land of voting rights reauthorization, end the right to work laws, and end the expensive war in Iraq that has gone awry. We cannot fight for democracy, live and die for it in Iraq, and don't have it at home. We demand voter reauthorization, and we demand it right now. We're inextricably bound together. That's why we sing, if there's a leak in the inner tube of democracy, it affects the whole tire. The Native American vote in South Dakota, the Latino vote in the Southwest, Black and Latino votes in the South, advance the fight for workers' right to organize, for women's right to self-determination. We're all inextricably bound. And fraud is visited upon Black and Brown voters in the South. It disenfranchises workers and human rights everywhere. August 6th, be in Atlanta in big numbers. Lest we forget, the clock keeps ticking. The entire Congress is up for re-election next year. There are major races for governor and state offices. We must not let our internal fights weaken our cooperation in these vital external fights. We need a new Congress, a new Senate. We must fight and keep our eyes on the real prize. Keep our eyes on 2006. Keep our eyes on the Senate. Keep our eyes on the Congress. Keep our eyes on right to organize. Keep our eyes on NLRB that's not anti-labor. Keep our eyes on the real prize. We must make a strategic adjustment. Today, I must say I am not pleased with Democrats, and I am not scared of Republicans. We must frame a new partnership. Republicans strongly attack us. Democrats offer a weak defense with fuzzy ideology. Under their watch, we've borne the brunt of NAFTA and three strikes. It's not an accident that the day the DOC meets in Ohio, as labor argues in Chicago. The DOC embraces CAFTA and sales admission to its conferences to corporate lobbyists. We do not need one party with two names. The DOC is not a legitimate extension of the Democratic Party. It is a privatized interest group of corporate lobbyists. We register voters. They take credit for victory. We must go on the offensive. We must open up the process with a third rail. We must negotiate a new deal with the Democratic Party and change the options of the radical right. We must use litigation, legislation, state referenda, and ballot initiatives and demonstrations. We've joined the party, but the party must join our movement for fundamental change. We must change the political environment by moving the earth with massive ground action. Here's what makes Chicago move. There's something called the elevator train as a third rail. Without the third rail, the train on the two tracks just don't move. It's the third rail for the electricity is the change agent. In slavery, the liberals said, be kind to them. Conservatives said, they are our property. Abolitionists, the third rail, said, end the system. The third rail, that's where the heat is. That's where the juice is. The women's struggle for the right to vote did not come from either party. It was an independent third rail action. The labor struggles in the 30s were not led by either party. It was an independent driven by workers' real needs, not party needs. The 55 bus boycott against segregation was independent third rail. The 64 civil rights and voting rights struggles were independent. They were third rail. We went to Selma. We bled enough and died enough and risked enough. The third rail. We wrote the Voting Rights Act in blood. It was co-signed in ink. When we act, we make the whole nation move. The party must join our struggle for liberation. We cannot join theirs for status quo adjustment, tinkering, and managing crisis. Our future, hear me now, is not going with either party, but rather to create enough legitimate people's action for both parties to follow us. Our drive is not to project and protect milquetoast Democrats or bold anti-civil rights, anti-labor rights Republicans. We must have our own street heat action and fight for health care and jobs and right to organize. They must follow us. We cannot follow them because they ain't going nowhere. They must follow us because we, the working people, are going somewhere. We need to organize. We need to march. We need to fight back. This land is our land. We must build an independent political struggle that will define priorities and behavior of both parties. Who is your neighbor who takes risks with you? Who is your neighbor who sacrifices? Who is your neighbor? I say labor, civil rights, bill an ark, build a new covenant. Let's rise up today, protect our interests. Rise up today, fight through our tears. Rise up today, overcome our pain. Rise up today, choose reconciliation over polarization. Rise up today. We must turn to each other, not on each other. Reach out and create a real one big tent struggle. I'm glad to be with those who are here today. I reach out for those who are not here. We all belong on the one big tent, fighting for jobs and justice and health care and peace. Keep hope alive. Keep one big tent. Health care. Right to organize. Livable wage. Save the children. Open up trade unions. End the war. Decent housing. A new Congress. A new Senate. And a legitimate president. Keep hope alive.
You've been listening to the Reverend Jesse Jackson's Strategy for Labor speech delivered at the Chicago AFL-CIO convention. When Jackson delivered a similar speech at the convention 2 years ago, advocating mass mobilization against the war on labor, his prescription was loudly applauded and quietly ignored. This time he went further, calling for an end to the war and a new approach to the Democratic Party. Whether the leadership will respond is one question. Whether the ranks within the AFL-CIO and the Change to Win coalition will respond is the real question. The convention delegates certainly came forward in the vote to withdraw from Iraq, which is the subject of our next report. I'm outside the AFL-CIO convention hall with Gene Brushkin, co-convener of U.S. Labor Against the War, and we're talking about the historic resolution that the AFL-CIO passed to end the war and occupation of Iraq. I had understood that the AFL-CIO was trying to delay the resolution so it would only come up till the end of the conference on Thursday, and then it was pushed forward to yesterday.
The decision that was made this weekend at the Resolutions Committee of the AFL was that the resolution would read on the issue of withdrawal, that they would bring the troops home as quickly as possible, number one, and number two, that the resolution would be discussed on Thursday morning, which is the end of the convention, and you'll have an empty room. So we thought that that was inappropriate.
So what happened?
We made our opinion known to the council, and we asked those people who had an interest in seeing these resolutions properly discussed to communicate to Jerry McEntee and others our opinion, and we held a forum on Monday night that 150 people attended with the Iraqis to discuss the occupation and the U.S. labor against the war, and importantly to decide how to make sure that this situation was corrected. As a result of that meeting, message got to the Executive Council. They discussed it. they decided that they would accept the word rapidly, bring the troops home rapidly instead of as soon as possible, and that they would bring it up yesterday for a full debate. So we were pleased, and that's what happened.
You know, and everybody's going to get out their dictionaries at this point, because the question then becomes, what is the definition of rapidly? Some people are thinking that this is not as good as the resolution that was before, which said immediate pullout.
U.S. law, the resolutions are sort of base resolutions, call for immediate withdrawal. I think that the general feeling was, of all the people who spoke, was like, get them out of there, get the troops home, end the occupation. This is what Jesse Jackson said in the morning, bring the troops home, bring the troops home, and bring the troops home. And that was the tenor of the entire discussion, and our sense is we want them home fast. The question of immediate, in a way, although that's the word we have suggested in general, it's a word game, because immediate means in 5 minutes. So we want them home, we want them home fast, and we want an end to the occupation. That was the sense. In fact, in the discussion on the floor, some of the people supporting the resolution said that this is to bring them home immediately.
The chair, Leo Garrard from the Steelworkers, what was his interpretation?
Leo started off by saying that there were 18 resolutions submitted from all over the country calling for an end to the occupation and bringing the troops home, and that there was widespread sentiment, and that's why I was coming to the floor. And what was interesting is that lined up at every one of the four mics were long lines of people standing up and denouncing the occupation and calling for the removal of the U.S. troops. So I think the message was very clear that this is not something in Bush's discretion that will set a date in a calendar some other time. We want them home.
Do you think the FLCIO is going to really push this now, or are they going to sit on their hands?
My guess is that, like a lot of other resolutions, particularly on these kind of issues, they can be seen symbolically by the Federation. And in fact, they can often be symbolic. But first of all, the symbolism is extremely important, because it puts the FLCIO on record. It is also important because for those thousands and thousands of activists around the country, it gives them an opportunity to go to their local and state bodies and to their organization and say, we've got to be against this war and be out there publicly, because even at the highest levels of the labor movement, they've condemned the wars based on lies and they called for bringing the troops home. So for the people out in the field who are really the ones that bring people into the streets, this opens a lot of doors, and we intend to make sure that this resolution is seen on the streets and in the union halls.
There's another part of the resolution that causes a lot of people concern about the international community training security forces in Iraq.
The resolution was not the U.S. Labor Against the War resolution. It was a resolution of the Executive Council. And in that resolution were support for Iraqi labor rights, were demand that foreign debts to Saddam Hussein be forgiven, were denouncing the Bush war as based on lies and deception, and were calling for solidarity with Iraqi trade unionists. We agreed with all that stuff. There were things in there, in supporting the troops, demanding full rights for veterans, rights and benefits, supporting our own members and vets when they come home. There's a lot of stuff we agreed in. There were things in there that U.S. Labor and the War didn't agree with, and you don't get 100%. But what we decided is that rather than raise 11 issues that in a way were peripheral, we wanted to go to the one essential issue, which is, when are the troops coming home? And they wanted to say as quickly as possible. And clearly, as soon as you put the word as possible in there, you are giving the Bush administration the decision on what is possible. We based it on the resolution coming out of Philadelphia, which had broad support in the Labor Council among the construction trades, veterans, and a range of unions, where they call for a rapid withdrawal. So we figured that was a huge step in the right direction, and we got it through.
Do you think that the split in the FLCIO is causing them to be a bit more responsive to the delegates, to the membership?
They're certainly vulnerable at this point for the AFL-CIO, and we made it clear from our perspective that if we're trying to build and make changes in the labor movement, certainly having democratic debate and being responsive to the perspectives of such a wide range of your membership is absolutely crucial. And I think, to their credit, they heard it and they responded to it. But I think it was also to the credit of all the folks all over the country and many of their representatives that hear that they made sure their voices were heard.
What's the next step?
We have already been making sure that everyone all over the world knows that this is the case. And we believe that September 24th is a crucial date, and that unions should have buses out there that this has to be a situation where unions are seen on the street with their members, with their union banners, marching in the front of this march along with Iraqi vets and military families. We're going to encourage that. We're going to try and get official buy-in. And in fact, yesterday at the forum with Iraqi trade unionists, when Cecil Roberts, president of the United Mine Workers, said, "What can we do next?" One of the responses from the panelists, who's on, a woman from the Federation of Workers' Councils, were, "Bring your members into the street on September 24th. That would make a big difference to the Iraqis."
Now, the AFL-CIO still continues to receive about $35 million for the Solidarity Center through NED, National Endowment for Democracy. And actually, they're more dependent upon these funds now because of the AFL-CIO budget cutbacks. How do you think that portends for AFL-CIO foreign policy, both on Iraq and on other issues, say Venezuela?
We've had discussions with them, and we've had discussions within U.S. Labor Against the War. And we think that kind of dependency on government funds is a problem because we know that fundamentally the Bush agenda is not our agenda. And certainly in Iraq, for example, where the Bush agenda is to privatize Iraq using the IMF mandates and so on, forcing the huge public sector in Iraq to be slimmed down, privatized, and sold off, and that the Iraqi unions are going to need to oppose that. The AFL is in a difficult position when it really comes to direct conflict with the U.S. government's policy if their foreign policy arm is funded overwhelmingly by the Bush administration. What was interesting for us, as an example, we've actually said that we think members need to be involved in foreign policy, and we have done that in every way we can. And this most recent national tour of U.S. Labor Against the War was a good illustration where members, out of their own pocket, over a two-week period, funded $50,000 for the Iraqi tour, which enabled us to bring the Iraqis to the country, put them up, transport them, feed them, and shelter them for 2 weeks, get them home, and give each of the three federations $5,000. If we can do that in such an impromptu, grassroots way with U.S. Labor Against the War, we believe the AFL-CIO has the ability to actually generate funds from members and from local unions. The Canadians do it, and probably other countries, and we would encourage that kind of direction.
So to encourage people to become involved through their labor unions in the end to the war in Iraq, what should people do? How do people find more information?
Stay tuned to the U.S. Law website. We already have some flyers up there that you can use as a basis to generate your own flyers. It's www.uslaboragainstwar.org.
Thank you so much. I've been talking with Gene Breshkin, co-convener of U.S. Labor Against the War.
This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report, Chicago AFL-CIO convention special. Building Bridges is produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. You can reach us by emailing knash@igc.org. And you can listen to archive Building Bridges national programs at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.